Ekatra Podcast Conversations. For the curious, essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Yeah.
Today we're really getting into something significant, I think, a truly challenging journey.
Mm-hmm.
We're diving deep into Howard Zinn's, well, monumental and relentlessly critical work, A People's History of the United States.
Yeah, it's a book that just flips the whole perspective, doesn't it?
Completely.
Instead of, you know, the usual focus on leaders, presidents, generals, the winners, so to speak.
Your history written from the top.
Zinn turns it upside down. He writes American history from the bottom up.
So we're looking at these huge foundational moments, but through the eyes of, well, ordinary people.
Exactly. The workers, the dissenters, indigenous peoples, the enslaved, those whose voices are often lost.
So our mission today, really, is to unpack Zinn's revolutionary viewpoint, to understand what history looks like when the main characters aren't the powerful.
But those who resisted power.
Yeah. And maybe more importantly, why this way of looking at things is still so relevant, so potent today.
It really is, because this book, it's more than just an alternative history. It's almost like a toolkit for critical thinking.
How so?
Well, by showing history as this perpetual, often systemic struggle between the powerful and the powerless, Zinn fundamentally challenges that whole idea of American exceptionalism, you know,
yeah.
That smooth narrative of constant progress.
Right. The idea that everything just keeps getting better automatically.
He forces us to rethink what national unity even means when you look at it this way.
Okay. Let's start with the man himself. Howard Zinn, 1922 to 2010.
Right.
And he wasn't just writing from some comfortable academic perch, even though he had, you know, serious credentials. A PhD from Columbia.
No, his perspective was really forged elsewhere, in activism, on the front lines.
That seems crucial.
It is. He came from a working class background, but his big political turning point was actually World War II.
Serving as a bombardier.
Yeah, an Air Force bombardier. And he saw firsthand the impact on civilians. It just shattered his belief in the official story, the sort of morally superior narrative the U.S. military often presented.
Wow. And then his time teaching at Spelman College during the Civil Rights Movement.
That cemented it. He was right there in the South, deeply involved, not just studying history, but like actively making it.
Voter registration drives, organizing students.
Exactly. So this is why his perspective feels so different. It's this blend of real scholarly rigor, but combined with the absolute commitment of someone who's been on the front lines. His authority isn't just academic, it's moral.
It stems from that explicit choice he made, right? To side with the powerless.
Yes. And to make their ignored stories, their struggles, the central narrative of America.
Okay, so let's dig into the book's core idea.
Right.
Zinn kicks off in 1492 with a very deliberate aim.
Absolutely. To dismantle that myth of American exceptionalism.
By showing a history defined more by, well, exploitation and systemic injustice.
Precisely. And he does it right from page one, basically reframing the origin story.
Columbus.
Columbus's arrival isn't framed as some heroic discovery. It's presented as the start of a, well, a genocidal conquest. He details the destruction of the Arawak people.
It's a stark opening. It immediately tells you this isn't the history you learned in school.
Right. What you thought was a hero, Zinn says, look closer, maybe an oppressor.
And this reframing, it continues throughout the book, doesn't it? Major events.
Everything. The American Revolution, the Constitution, the Mexican-American War. He analyzes them all as kind of mechanisms.
Mechanisms used by elites.
Used by the elites already in power to consolidate that power, protect their wealth, and importantly, redirect popular anger away from themselves.
But it's not just about tearing things down, is it? There's a positive goal, too.
Oh, absolutely. Zinn is very clear. The real purpose here is empowerment.
How does he achieve that?
By showing the other side. The continuous history of resistance, slave revolts, labor strikes, feminist organizing. He demonstrates the resilience, the agency of ordinary people fighting back. He wants this history to be like a usable past, a blueprint.
A blueprint for future action.
Okay.
Okay. Let's move into the colonial foundations then.
Great.
Zinn really hammers home that the main driver was economic exploitation, the search for gold, for wealth.
Yeah. That's the engine. But what's fascinating and maybe disturbing is how quickly the elite figured out how to manage conflict.
You mean class conflict?
Specifically, yes. This is where Bacon's Rebellion in 1676 comes in. It's a pivotal moment for Zen.
Remind us what happened there.
Well, you had poor white indentured servants and enslaved Africans actually uniting, briefly, against the wealthy colonial rulers.
A combined force from the bottom? That must have scared the elite.
Terribly. And Zen argues their response was conscious and deliberate. They started constructing a formal racial hierarchy by giving poor whites slightly better status, some minor rights, specifically over Africans, to drive a wedge between them.
To prevent that kind of cross-racial, lower-class unity from ever happening again.
Exactly. A classic divide-and-conquer strategy built right into the structure of society.
And he argues that this division shaped the revolution itself.
Fundamentally, he sees the Revolutionary War less as a pure struggle for liberty for all.
And more as something orchestrated by the colonial elites.
To protect their own economic interests from the British, yes. But also using the language of liberty to manage the anger of the lower classes, redirecting it towards the crown. Tyranny is tyranny, as some pamphlets said at the time, whether it's British or local elites.
But isn't that a bit reductive? Surely the revolution did create some framework for future rights, even if flawed.
That's a fair point. And Zinn wouldn't deny that some positive things eventually emerged, but he'd push back on the motivation and the initial structure.
Okay.
He'd say, look at what came next. The Constitution. This wasn't created in a vacuum. The elite had just faced uprisings like Shay's Rebellion.
Where poor farmers took up arms because they were losing their land.
Right. So the Constitution, in Zinn's view, was designed primarily to protect property rights and stabilize the system against that kind of popular democratic threat.
So the famous checks and balances.
We're also there to check the power of the masses, to keep direct democracy contained.
Okay, shifting focus now. Westward expansion.
Mm-hmm. Here, Zinn exposes the stark hypocrisy between the democratic ideals being talked about back east and the reality on the frontier.
It wasn't manifest destiny.
No, it was a systematic policy of conquest. Ethnic cleansing, really?
Right.
Removing Native American nations to take their land.
He talks about figures like Tecumseh.
Yeah, who brilliantly tried to unify tribes against this expansion, but they faced overwhelming state-sponsored violence, leading to horrors like the Trail of Tears.
This logic of conquest, does it connect to how Zinn views the Civil War?
Directly. And this is one of his most provocative arguments. He shifts the focus away from Lincoln as the great emancipator.
And puts the agency where?
With the enslaved people themselves. Yeah. Zinn argues they essentially freed themselves through constant resistance, running away, revolts, sabotage, eventually providing crucial intelligence and labor to the Union Army once the war started. Their actions force the issue.
So for Zinn, the Emancipation Proclamation wasn't primarily a moral act from Lincoln.
It was strategic first, moral second, perhaps. Lincoln and the Northern elite, Zinn argues, were mainly focused on preserving the Union, keeping the Southern states in check, and securing Northern economic dominance.
And emancipation became a necessary tool to achieve that. To weaken the Confederacy.
Precisely. It was forced onto the agenda by the relentless actions of the enslaved people themselves. It came from the bottom up, pushing the top.
This pattern Zinn identifies economic drivers leading to violence seems consistent.
Always. Look at U.S. imperialism later on. The Mexican-American War, the Spanish-American War.
Zinn presents these not as defending liberty, but as
naked land grabs, driven by economic interests, markets, resources, and also useful for distracting from growing class tensions back home. Think about the Philippines occupation after the war with Spain. Brutal stuff.
That's a key connection Zinn makes, right? Foreign adventures distracting from domestic conflict.
Yes. And what happens when that violence, that control, needs to be applied internally? To manage the workforce needed for industrialization.
That brings us to what Zinn calls the other civil war.
Exactly. The huge, often violent class conflict during the industrial age, the Gilded Age.
This is where he details the intense struggles between labor and capital.
We often learn the names of the Rockefellers and Carnegies, the robber barons. Zinn forces us to remember the struggles. Haymarket, Pullman.
These weren't just strikes or riots in his view.
No, they were battlegrounds. Demonstrations of how corporate power effectively merged with state power, police, military, courts, to crush workers' movements.
So a direct line from the property-protecting goals of the Constitution.
To the union-busting tactics of the Gilded Age industrialists supported by the government.
And this internal repression connects to foreign policy too, like World War I.
Absolutely. Zinn critiques WWI as essentially a rich man's war, poor man's fight.
Fought over imperial rivalries.
But sold using patriotism. And then that same patriotism was weaponized against dissenters at home.
Through things like the Espionage and Sedition Acts?
Yeah, used explicitly to crush anti-war sentiment, socialists, union organizers. Eugene V. Debs imprisoned just for speaking out against the war, thousands jailed.
Even World War II, often called the Good War, Zinn examines critically.
He asks us to look beyond the main narrative, whose experience gets left out.
Like the internment of Japanese Americans.
Right. Or the continued segregation faced by African American soldiers fighting for a democracy that denied them basic rights. And he questions the morality of Allied strategic bombing. Dresden, Tokyo, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, causing immense civilian casualties.
But amidst all this critique, Zinn does find sources of hope, right? Particularly later in the 20th century.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. The grassroots movements of the 1960s and 70s are central to his sense of possibility.
The civil rights movement.
He highlights its genuine bottom-up power. People right. like Fannie Lou Hamer, SNCC organizers, ordinary people doing extraordinary things.
And the anti-Vietnam War movement as well.
Huge movements that really shook the establishment, challenged its legitimacy.
So how did the establishment respond, according to Zinn?
It's fascinating, not just with outright repression, though there's plenty of that.
COINTELPRO, things like that.
Right. But also with what Zinn calls co-optation, making strategic partial reforms.
Like the New Deal earlier or civil rights legislation later.
Exactly. Reforms designed to absorb the radical energy, ease the pressure, and restore stability.
Without fundamentally changing the underlying economic power structures. Give a little to save the system.
That's the argument, which leads us to maybe his most important idea for today, the coming revolt of the guards.
Okay, unpack that. Who are the guards?
The guards in Zinn's framework are basically the middle classes.
Teachers, skilled workers, professionals.
Yeah, people who are given just enough stability, enough privilege to make them loyal to the existing system. They act as a buffer between the very wealthy elite and the poor or marginalized underclass.
So the system's stability depends on keeping this middle group reasonably content.
Entirely. Their loyalty, their cooperation is crucial. They enforce the rules, they run the institutions.
And the revolt happens when?
When their own economic security starts to crumble, when their jobs become precarious, when wages stagnate, when the social contract they thought they had starts breaking down.
Which sounds familiar.
Very. Zinn predicted that as this precarity grew, their loyalty would erode. They might then start to see their interests aligning more with the underclass.
Sparking a potentially powerful new coalition for real fundamental change. It's a striking idea, especially now.
It really resonates when you look at discussions about inequality and middle class anxiety today.
Okay, if we try to boil down Zinn's massive work, what are the, say, three core themes listeners should take away?
Well, first, definitely that class conflict is the engine of American history.
Not shared values, but conflicting interests.
Pretty much. The constant tension between the interests of the wealthy elite, property, profit control, and the needs and aspirations of working people, the poor, the marginalized.
So major historical events are often attempts to manage this conflict.
Right. It challenges that whole idea of a unified national interest. Zinn says, whose interests are we really talking about? History is a battleground over resources and power.
Okay. Theme number two.
The agency and resistance of ordinary people. This is crucial.
That change doesn't just come from the top down.
Exactly. Zinn argues that real, lasting, positive change almost always comes from organized resistance from below.
Slave revolts forcing the issue of emancipation, strikes winning labor rights, protests changing policy.
Yes. It's a continuous thread. So the real story of America isn't just about presidents and laws. It's about this ongoing struggle for justice by everyday people. It provides a kind of hope, a model.
And the third key theme.
Has to be the role of government in protecting elite interests.
This is the skeptical lens he encourages.
Right. To view government institutions, laws, policies, not just based on their stated intentions, but on who they actually benefit in practice.
So even progressive reforms, while maybe good in themselves,
were often, in his view, calculated responses. Reactions to pressure from below, designed to stabilize the system and prevent more radical change, rather than fundamentally redistribute power or wealth.
It definitely encourages you to always ask, qui bonus con? Who benefits?
Always. question the source, question the motivation.
Zinn had a way with words, too. He wasn't using dry academic prose. He used sharp, memorable lines.
Yeah, language meant to provoke thought, maybe even action.
Probably his most famous quote relates to political action. The problem in this world is not civil disobedience.
But civil obedience. Powerful stuff.
What's the core message there?
It's a direct challenge to passive compliance. He's saying the real danger isn't people breaking unjust laws, it's people following them without question.
That obeying unjust systems is the bigger threat to justice.
Exactly. It completely reframes what active citizenship requires. It demands questioning authority.
And there's another idea, maybe not a direct quote, but central to his method.
Mm-hmm.
The notion that history, written from a comfortable viewpoint, from the perspective of the winners,
can never truly understand justice, because you have to listen to the cries of the poor, the oppressed.
That's the heart of his people's history, isn't it?
It really is. It's a call for empathy, yes, but also for a complete moral reorientation, a reminder that knowledge isn't neutral. It depends on whose perspective you prioritize.
Which connects to that other great line.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know history, it is as if you were born yesterday.
And if you were born yesterday, anybody can tell you anything.
That just perfectly captures why this matters.
Absolutely. History is power. Understanding the past, especially the hidden or suppressed parts of the past, is essential to avoid being manipulated by the narratives handed down by those in power today.
So let's bring this home. How can we, you know, practically apply Zinn's perspective in our daily lives?
Well, one immediate application is critical media literacy.
How so?
When you read the news, watch a report, listen to a politician, apply Zinn's questions automatically.
Who benefits from this story being told this way?
Right. And crucially, whose voice, whose suffering, whose perspective is missing here?
It helps you spot the language that obscures reality, maybe. Like calling civilian deaths collateral damage.
Exactly. It trains you to look beneath the surface narrative.
Okay, well.
It leads to more informed civic engagement.
Because you understand the deep roots of problems.
Yes. If you see things like racism or economic inequality, not just as current issues, but as problems with deep structural histories going back centuries.
As Zinn shows they do.
Then your actions to address them become potentially more effective. You start thinking about changing systems, not just treating symptoms.
That makes sense. And maybe it also helps us reevaluate patriotism.
I think so.
Yeah.
Zinn offers a different model. Instead of patriotism meaning unconditional loyalty to the state or its past actions.
It could mean something else.
It could mean expressing your love for the country's ideals by dissenting, by criticizing power, by working to close the gap between those ideals and the reality. True patriotism as active struggle for a better future, not blind worship of the past.
For me, thinking about this deep dive, the thing that really sticks is Zinn's insistence that historical knowledge isn't neutral.
Right. It's not just facts and dates.
He saw it as a tool, even a weapon, often used by the powerful to justify their position and maintain control. His whole book feels like an attempt to give that weapon back to ordinary people.
By arming them with the knowledge of their own history, their own continuous history of resistance.
Yeah.
And I think that's the final enduring insight, really. Recognizing that the official story isn't the only story. There's this parallel, often hidden narrative of persistent, courageous, creative resistance from below.
And seeing that.
Seeing that turns history from just a collection of facts about the past into something active, an ongoing argument about the present and about what kind of future we want to build. It challenges you, the listener, to see yourself not just as an observer, but as part of that continuing story, as an agent of change.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker. Another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Katra Foundation.